Welcome to Lost in Transformation. This is Ming Labs, podcasting from Singapore, an international innovation center, business hub, and startup supporter. Learn from digital thought leaders and designers about innovation and transformation of businesses in an ever-evolving digital world. Coming up is your host, Sebastian Müller, co-founder of Ming Labs, with our guest for today, Tim Wieringer. Tim is a passionate ambassador for positive leadership, design thinking, and intrinsic motivation. He guides teams and organizations to improve their agility and excellence in all aspects of the business, focusing on the people side of change, what he likes to call people excellence. Currently at Huntsman, he is an internal consultant for innovation and guiding teams to improve on cross-silo collaboration. We hope you enjoy the conversation and look forward to your feedback.
Hi, Tim. Thanks for your time for joining us on our podcast. We're excited to record yet another episode of Lost in Transformation. And I think in terms of speaking with experts on transformation, we couldn't do too much better than speaking to somebody in charge of transformation and change management. So maybe to get us started, you could just tell us a little bit about your journey in the past. What have you been doing, and how have you come to be in the role that you have today and being interested in the topic of transformation and change management?
Sure, Sebastian. It's great to be here, and I hope I can be sharing some interesting expertise. My journey from where I come from and where I'm today has started in being a consultant for business process designs. Out of this one, because there was a strong focus on how people collaborate along processes, I moved into knowledge management, building communities, bringing people to work together. And if you are implementing these new, in many ways, new ways of working, you stumble across change management. So then since 2012, roughly, I was really focusing on change management. In different manufacturing and now in a global role as well.
So. Yeah. One of the big topics there is always this topic of people excellence. How can we enable the people, et cetera? What does this mean to you in your role?
Yeah, I mean, when you talk to people about change management, often you get and not again. And like even the term transformation, people say, what is that about? I mean, I'm doing my business, so what do I need to transform? And for me, the essence of change management is actually, or the key result of change management is actually driving excellence. It is also about making people comfortable, but in the end, we want to make a better business. So that's why I focus a lot on excellence. And at the same time, I truly believe that, yes, we can improve our processes, we can improve our systems, we can improve our organization and structures, we can improve a lot. But in the end, it only works if the people, the foundation, is working towards this objective. So that's why I like to push the term of people excellence, because it's about reaching excellence through our people. And that's what people excellence is for me.
Right. So in that regard, what kind of tools, methods do you use? What have you found useful? How does it work?
My approach there, and I recently talked to my former boss about it, and he said they actually have a very unique approach to it, and not many people are following the way you are doing it. And the way he expressed it, and that gave me a good insight as well. Most of the projects are either about reaching business results or are about changing culture. And my approach is actually trying to combine these two. Yes, in my projects, I want to change a culture, but I'm using business results, new routines to actually achieve that. And it's always important to focus on both. And some people, I mean, it's sometimes difficult to convince people or keep track of that, because a lot of people want immediate business results. And it's good to achieve them. But at the same time, always keeping in mind, what are the mindset shifts? What are the cultures I want to reach? I think that's a little bit from a methodology point of view. Tools, there's a lot of elements of design thinking which I'm using there as well, just to be creative, because I also believe you need to innovate a lot more to achieve better results. I mean, if you can incrementally improve all the time, but in the end, if you really want to be successful, you need to make a bigger shift. You need to transform, not just change in a way. So that's one key element there. And another one is also bringing people closer in there and how they collaborate with each other. And there's a lot of cross-silo collaboration where I'm focusing on, and building relationship as well via more interactions. I think that's one of the tools, methods I'm using there as well. I'm not sure if that's going the right direction.
Yeah, absolutely. So you mentioned this aspect of culture, which is something that is often referenced, but it's really hard to kind of nail down what is a culture, and specifically for an organization, what is the culture of the organization. We often see big companies that publish value statements and vision, mission statements, but they're honestly generic and people don't believe in them and don't believe that that actually is what the company is. So what does the term culture mean to you, and how can we actually really effectively think about that as it relates, as you mentioned, to reaching real business objectives?
There's one book I recently read about anthropology and corporate anthropology, and their definition of culture was very interesting to me, because they basically said anthropology as an academic area defines culture as the space between people.
Okay.
And that's actually quite interesting. And in this term as well, I mean, there's a lot of mission statements and value statements and that. And I like to, from a practical perspective, see culture as a set of values of the people. And what I'm doing with certain teams as well is what I call a vision to action exercise. And what I'm doing there is actually I allow the team to discover their own values. And I mean, there's always some activities on a corporate level where we define our values and mission statement and so on.
Yeah.
At the same time, I think it's much more valuable for the team to identify their own values and express them, and translate that into what I call a meaningful purpose statement.
Mm-hmm.
And this is then basically reflecting the culture of that unit.
Yeah.
And it might be the culture which is currently there. It might be the culture where they want to go. And in the end, it doesn't matter, right? I think that's a little bit what I feel. I mean, that's what they say. And they might say things which are already there. They might say things where they want to be.
Yeah. But what if you now say that the team can discover their own culture, and that maybe is not perfectly aligned with the overall corporate, would that be an issue? Or do you think it's actually fine for smaller organizational units to have a bit of their own culture?
And I think that comes back with that. That's why I like this definition, because culture is something which is there.
Yeah.
And if the team defines this is our culture, then it's their culture. If it's not aligned what the top leadership team thinks the culture of the company is or wants to be, then we discover some discrepancies which we need to address.
Right.
But we cannot deny that this team says this is what we want to do. And if this team is successful, then maybe they're doing something right.
Yeah. Yeah.
So I think that's where it needs to go. And for sure, if on a corporate level, they say we want to go in a different direction, we can start a journey in another direction, but we cannot change the culture. The culture is something which is. It's not something which you can influence the culture, but you cannot have a switch and change it. That's my thoughts around that. It's an interesting topic, culture in itself, that's for sure.
Yeah, especially in big corporations. I mean, having started a couple of companies, and in the beginning, it's always fairly easy, I would say. It kind of forms around like the founder or the founders and whatever behavior they display and they accept or they punish. That kind of becomes the cultural norm, which can easily be disturbed, especially when the company or the office is small by newcomers, because there's no critical mass, really. Any one person can seriously influence this. How is that in a big corporation? I mean, you've mainly been working with larger enterprises where probably the founder is either not around anymore, maybe not such a huge influence. It has been transformed into a structure that's supposed to last for hundreds of years, if not indefinitely, in theory. How can a culture perpetuate itself? Any thoughts around that?
I mean, when I look at, for example, the organization where I'm currently playing a lot in, is there are a lot of different cultures, and that's what I see. I mean, sometimes it's a regional division which has a specific culture, and sometimes it's just a local team or a global team, but they're like just 15 people. They have their own culture. For sure, you can see traces of an overall culture. At the same time, each team, each group of people is developing their own culture. And that's why I like this definition. Culture is a space between people. And it shifts on the group of people you're looking at. It shifts with the people who are coming in or out. It's a moving element, culture. And it's also quite interesting to see. I mean, it's an interesting anecdote, interesting story in the current organization. Because there has been a lot of, the company grew with acquisitions. Yeah. And some of these acquisition has been integrated, some of them not. And in sort of the very distinct business units or divisions in the organization, and we have operations all over, and there are actually two different factories for two different business units in near Bangkok. Mm-hmm. They're literally less than an hour drives away. So I went one day to the first factory and the next day to the next factory. And honestly, the only thing which was the same was the company logo outside. And everything else was different. The way the people dress, the way the people walk, the way the people interact in the workshop, the way the lunch is organized, the way they talk to each other. Yeah. Everything was different. The company logo was the same, but that was it. And it depends on how you integrate teams and integrate, let people interact with each other, so defining the space between people.
Good. Mm. That's very interesting.
That was an interesting surprise for me as well.
Yeah.
But at the same time, I have to say there are traces of behavior in that matter, which are across all the teams across the globe. I mean, there are roughly 10,000 people, and you see traces of behavior across everybody as well.
Yeah. Mm. And then now if we shift, or we look at this culture and see, okay, now we are looking to transform ourselves. The big topic is digital transformation, which often then comes with new behaviors in terms of this whole topic of a new work. Now we have to work customer-centric and people-centric and agile, small experiments, fail fast. So introducing new behaviors into a culture that exists, a company that exists, how can you really successfully engage in something like that? And maybe what are some of the pitfalls that you need to look out for when you're trying to roll out these new behaviors?
I mean, one thing with that term behavior, I stumbled across it a few times. And for myself, I mean, I mentioned it before in that context, but most often I actually try to distinguish between routines and habits and mindset. Mm-hmm. For me, behavior lies somewhere in between and is sometimes a little bit fuzzy because some people relate more to habits and routines and some people it's more like a mindset. So that's why I try actually to really distinguish the two.
Yeah.
When it comes to transformations and or digital transformation, the one thing, and that's what I mentioned in the beginning as well, the one thing I always try to keep in mind and looking at the big picture, what are the mindset shifts which I want to initiate? Mm-hmm. You mentioned customer focus. This is a mindset that whatever activities I'm doing, I'm going away from an internal focus to a customer focus, to a stakeholder focus. And I think that's, for example, a mindset which I want to do. One of the mindset which I'm focusing on is this willingness to fail. I mean, it doesn't need to be perfect. It's more important to get started. Another mindset is, and in the digital spaces, is also that what you mentioned, to get quicker results, to get something tangible and present it to your stakeholders and get feedback on that. Adam, these are a few of these mindsets which are important. At the same time, let's put it like this. I think it's easier to shape routines than it's to shape mindset. It is possible, but it takes a lot of time.
Yeah.
I mean, I can talk about value creation. I can talk about customer focus for many, many, many times. And the chance that people then actually shift is relatively low. So that's why I say, okay, let's keep this mindset on the top of our head, the big picture. At the same time, okay, what are habits and routines we can start which are then influencing this mindset?
Yeah.
So for example, so since quite a while now, I'm supporting the R&D teams in Shanghai. And there we get into these routines, which I call ideation cycles, which are about finding new ideas for technology projects. And what I'm pushing them to do, I mean, there needs to be some convincing at the beginning. It cannot just say, do it. And I'm not a believer in telling people what to do. So there needs to be some convincing, but sometimes also a little bit of a push to push people into trying these new routines. And this is a routine about getting input to an issue or input to a challenge with a lot more people than you would usually do. So we're doing this on a regular basis. Every 4 months, we go through one of these cycles. And this is on top of their daily work. And there was very good responses. And one guy actually stood up and said, yeah, in the past, I was fixing my issues by myself. Now, the first thing I do is I'm reaching out to my colleagues and peers to get their input. And he said, this is so much better. Yeah. And this is the mindset shift as a result of these new routines.
Okay.
And the pitfall in this context is as well that very often people think, and sometimes with some consultants as well, come up with great ideas on how to shift these mindsets, which are then too complicated. I think we just need to start with simple things and being agile about it as well. I mean, just start with something instead of having the big picture in mind, but just start with something small and build on top of that. So the pitfall, what I often see, is that these campaigns are just too big.
Yeah. Big, lofty goals, large transformation programs.
Yeah.
But then the small pieces are not there.
Yeah. And then also not focusing on quick results. And that's what the difference there is as well. I mean, we want to have quick results. Yeah.
So it means if you then pick one of these habits or routines where you say, okay, now we'll do, I don't know if you call it an intervention. Sometimes I hear intervention.
Yeah.
Now let's do this a bit differently. Let's do a hackathon or an ideation piece. Then it also actually needs to bear fruit and it really needs to be a success. Otherwise, the mindset shift is not going to happen, right?
Yeah. And the mindset shift is not going to happen, but also it's about sponsorship. I mean, interesting that you mentioned hackathon, because we did that in the organization as well. And we were, typically a hackathon that people can come up with their own ideas and have 1 or 2 or 3 days to come up with solutions to these ideas in whatever environment you're doing it.
Right.
And we were looking at that as well and then said, okay, that might be difficult to convince our leadership teams. So what we said, we went to the leadership teams, you choose the challenges, you choose the topics, and you are then a sponsor of this topic. So that means we have resources, people available, and that, which are then also taking these ideas and implement that.
Yeah.
And that has been one of the things which you need to keep in mind as well. But there's a pitfall as well. Great idea, just let's do it. And then forgetting that there needs to be business results, especially in today's world. I think very few people are doing things which are just for fun. Even though they're just, I mean, I also believe that this just for fun has business results, but not a direct, tangible business result.
Right. I think it's often said that to a new routine or behavior to really take hold, it takes, I think it was 60 days or 90 days. When you put it in the context of the mindset, would the mindset then, if the routine is good enough, come along with that? Or would that take like even longer and multiple routines and behaviors that then lead to, routines and habits that then lead to one mindset?
Yes, I mean, it depends on in general, I would say, yeah, the routine is in place as an automatic response. Takes 60 to 90 days, depending on the complexity. And I think the mindset shift will happen afterwards.
Yeah.
But it's always like some people click faster. I mean, there's always an average. Some people click faster. They only take like one cycle and they, oh, yeah, that's the best. And some take more time.
Right.
Yeah.
Yeah, there's an interesting distinguishing between the mindset and the actual routine or habit. I mean, we do a lot in the whole design thinking space. And then what I see is that it has become really a very empty buzzword where people, they might go through one training, or they might do one workshop, and then they say, yeah, design thinking, check, now we got it. But the actual mindset behind that, which is this whole human centricity, customer centricity, there's no change whatsoever. All they're acquiring is maybe a couple of tools. Yeah, now we do a persona, now we do these kinds of ideations, and we do everything on post-its, cool. But the actual mindset does not shift one bit. And oftentimes people, I feel, are disillusioned very quickly by design thinking after they go through, I don't know, either a 1 or 2 day workshop or maybe one cycle. But it actually, it really takes a couple of cycles, doesn't it, to then shift that mindset and actually get to the point that is the whole idea behind it, right?
Yeah, exactly. And it takes these results to actually realize people, oh, wow, this is much, much better. And I was just thinking, what could be another example of mindset? But there's one very interesting example as well, where we changed the routines, and it was difficult to change these routines, and we got excellent results. And this was in the context of product development, cross-functional teams, which need to develop new products for customers. So that's in the specialty chemical business. So that's not something which is easily done. And the regional leadership team, the directors asked me, can you check what they're doing? Because we don't think that these teams are working very effectively. And I had discussions and then asked, they did some changes. And then the interesting thing was, after 3 months, the directors came back to me and asked, what did you do? Because the results are better. The results are on time. We see there's a better team knit. And at the same time, the people are not really complaining that they did a lot of different things. So they asked me, what did you do? And I said, we only did one simple thing. We changed the frequency of their team meetings. So they used to meet every 3 weeks. And it's meeting means phone calls typically, because these are dispersed teams. So they used to have these calls every 3 weeks. And some of the teams, I have to admit, it's not all of the teams at once, but some of the teams I could convince to have a weekly team call.
Yeah.
And that changed a lot. And it's really that, in this case, we really had to push this routine. Some got it very quickly and they did it immediately. And some only changed it after they saw the results of the other teams. But this has triggered a lot of positive results. And also a different way they collaborate and work together.
Yeah.
And it's quite interesting to note they didn't spend more time in meetings. Because in the past, they were like having 1.5 hour meetings every 3 weeks. And then they had 20 minutes meetings every week. Because
yeah.
It was clear to what to discuss. And it's this kind of new routines, which sometimes you need to have a little bit of a far sight, because you can't really see that. So what is that routine of the frequency of meeting has to do with closer team knit and a different yeah. way to work together. And sometimes you need to have that experience or previous exposure to really see that this will happen.
Yeah. And as some of these things really take a while, I suppose, when it's coming to more complex mindsets or maybe more larger interventions. I mean, it can probably easily take also half a year or a year before you see real results. How can you talk to the leaders, the department heads, whoever it might be, who usually want to see quick results, you know, give it a couple of weeks, give it a month, now let's see the impact, to say, guys, no, we have to actually persevere here. We have to give this a while. Otherwise, nothing is going to happen.
Yeah, and that's where I try to look at quick results, because the big mindset shift. So that's the problem with initiatives, which are only changing the mindset.
Yeah,
I mean, it's possible to do that. You do that with journeys as well. And this takes a year, maybe even two sometimes. And it's difficult to get funds for that, get sponsorship for that. And that's why I'm trying to combine the two things. For example, saying yes, and also the steps in the journey and what we did, what we initiated a new, what we call an innovation program in one of the factories in Thailand, which is, it's just about operational excellence. So how can we get... And I'm trying to avoid here cost reduction, but I really pushed, and that's really the objective of the team. How can we get more results and more output with the assets we have? And what we did there, I mean, what the concept of this program is actually putting two things together, is like a design thinking intervention where we are creative in getting ideas how to improve. And then going through these cycles I mentioned before as well, to then in a more agile manner, manner execute these ideas. And we just conducted this design thinking 1.5 days workshop.
Yeah.
And with the results there, you could already see that there will be a huge positive impact. And that's the kind of quick result. Okay, it's not yet the financial impact, but with these relatively quick results after 2 months into the program, where you show results, will show success early on, that and the leadership team are seeing, yes, let's continue. Let's see. Okay, it's not too bad what Tim is doing here. But it's true. It takes a lot of convincing. And even though I'm an internal consultant, it's not that projects come automatically. So you need to have a little bit of a common understanding from a specific regional or global leader to say, yes, I think what you say is going in the right direction. And let's give it a try. You need that. And not everybody has that.
But in these situations, is it an advantage that you're an internal consultant rather than somebody who's trying to maybe bring in something new from the outside? Does that give you any advantages in terms of what you're able to do or what you're able to convince them of?
I mean, one advantage is I don't have to talk about fees, right?
Yeah. Right.
I mean, the other advantage is that I can commit for a longer period of time, which is typically difficult or very expensive for an external consultant. So I mentioned the R&D teams in Shanghai. I'm supporting them for 3 years now, and you can't do that as an external consultant. And now this innovation program is a program which the first cycle of the entire program will be 12 months. And theoretically, or let's see what happens, can never know what happened in the end, but theoretically I can support them for multiple years as well in this specific journey as well. So this is the big advantage of being an internal consultant. And at the same time, I can be this external or independent sparring partner and bring an external observation point into the discussion. So that's good as well. And I know the culture a little bit as well, so that makes it easier as well.
Right.
At the same time, you need to work harder at credibility as well. I mean, very often I hear that some leadership teams have contacted one of these typical names which you get in the business consulting space, and then I said, I could have done that as well.
Yeah.
But they either didn't know or didn't trust, or there's a lot of reasons why they didn't come to me with these projects, and that's also the disadvantage of being an internal consultant.
So do you think it's the best way to drive change in a position like yours from the inside? Or do you also see scopes where it really makes sense to say, okay, I actually want something who's from the outside?
Then it really depends on that specific team or specific person in that internal consultancy role and how it's set up.
Yeah.
What is important? I mean, a lot of organizations today are so lean that they cannot make a transformation because simply the resources are tied up in daily business. They don't have breathing space. They don't have reflection space to actually think about what could we transform and how could we transform. And they might not also have the experience, but even if they have the experience, they just don't have the space. So that's why you need an external consultant or a consultant for that who is not in that daily business. What is important, what could be the danger with an internal consultant is that this person is getting too complacent or too familiar with the entire organization. So it's important, even you are an internal consultant, if you do it with an internal consultant, that this internal consultant has a broad point of view and looks at a lot of different things.
Right.
And this is something you automatically get with an external, like really external consultant. But I also see the internal consultants who are then other functions, which are then almost too close to daily business. And then they cannot really reflect on it.
Yeah. Interesting. Zooming a bit out from that particular part, I'd like to get just a little bit back to the whole change management mindset shift and so forth again. Is there any difference that you see between people in different geographies, countries, cultures? I mean, you work globally with teams from the US and from Europe, from different parts of Asia. Do you see that there are certain cultures that are more responsive or less responsive to change or to certain mindsets? Is there any pattern like that?
Coming back to that example from our two factories in Bangkok, I really think there is a lot of different cultures, which are very, very close. So it really depends on where you are. One thing which a lot of people say, and in a way it's true, that a lot of the activities which I'm doing is driving leadership styles from command and control to facilitate and guide.
Yep.
Looking traditionally at an Asian leadership style, it's a lot of command and control. And there's two aspects to that which makes it then more relative. It hasn't been different 50 years back in Europe that there was a lot of command and control.
Right.
So, and I always like to say, we are all special, but we're all humans. we're all human and we work in a similar way. So having said that, this command and control was in the past in Europe as well, and it still exists in Europe. It's not that we got rid of it.
Yeah.
It's just maybe as an average, we are less in command and control and more in facilitate and guide. And then at the same time, there are really great leaders in Asia, like native leaders in Asia, which give a lot of autonomy, give a lot of space to people, trust their people, and are in this facilitate and guide space. So it's very dangerous to say, I'm going to Asia and I need to tell now these people to not command and control. And in the end, it boils always back to observe and see what's currently there. Wherever you are, don't assume, don't judge. That's what I'm doing. I'm just going in there. I see what they're looking for. And that's what is also fascinating with me reading this corporate anthropology book, because that's in the end what you need to do. You need to go into a space and be open and just observe and see what's there and what do they need and how do they want it.
Yeah.
And without judgment and without assumption, I think it's very dangerous to assume anything, because it most probably is different than you. It will be different than you assume. At the same time, I think there's certain principles, and that's what that was the part about being special. We're all special. We need to see who we're talking to.
Yeah.
And at the same time, we're all human. And then I think there are certain principles which I believe in. And I also saw results there that moving towards facilitate and guide is motivating people.
Mm-hmm.
And is motivating people in Americas, in Africa, in Europe, in Asia, in all the different cultural regions in Asia. It's motivating them. And I've seen that firsthand. And so if somebody tells me, you need to command and control in Asia, I say, yes, if you don't want good results, you can do command and control. If you want extraordinary results, you could do facilitate and guide and motivate these people from inside. That's where that's this human thing where we work the same. We are attracted to the same things.
Yeah, they already touched quite a bit on the kind of shift in leadership styles that we see today. Maybe let's zoom in a little bit on that. So you talk about command and control, which is kind of the previous paradigm that people were in, and now we're shifting to something that you call facilitating guide. Could you maybe elaborate a little bit on that, on what these two paradigms kind of stand for, how they manifest, and also then how can we actually make that shift? Because they sound quite different, at least on the surface.
Yes, it's most often it's a very big shift. And command and control, it's all about setting rules. It's about controlling other people, following my rules. I need to tell the people what to do. And it's this top-down push. You need to improve your sales targets until next quarter. Otherwise, I will, punish you. But it also goes the other way around. You have an excellent, if you reach, let's put it like that, if you reach these 5 million in the next quarter, you get a very nice bonus. That's also command and control. Yeah. You're commanding what to do and you're controlling that it's reached.
The carrot and the stick.
Carrot and the stick. I think I like that book Drive from Daniel Pink, which he said, this is if this, then that. He calls it if this, then that. Carrot and stick in simple terms. And we have to realize that this is actually demotivating and frustrating, even if it's a carrot, because it creates that anxiety not to reach it. And expanding a little bit. I mean, in the US, people are very, very fond of that. You have to give tips to waiter that they make give you better service. And whenever I'm in the US, I realize that this service is so superficially good that you can actually see the fear below that smile, behind that smile. You can see that fear. So it doesn't give you good service, right? And that's carrot and stick, that command and control thing, which is creating frustration, is demotivating people. It's then also leading to a lot of cost related to fluctuation and health issues in people, and also leads to low quality of service and products. And nobody is measuring that. And at the same time, it feels as a leader the easy way out. Yeah, I mean, if I tell people what to do, then they will do it. It's good. Then they do it. Most probably they will do it.
So the kind of the stigma of leadership, no? Yeah, I'm in charge.
I'm in charge and it brings me good results.
Yeah.
And it brings you these incremental results, which I often say I'm not interested in. I mean, you should not be interested in 10% increases in whatever you want to increase, because that's not enough, I think, in today's world. And I think the difficulty here is to let go. For a lot of leaders, it's that difficult to let go of this control. Basically, I mean, and that's a lot to do which is called intrinsic motivation, or the motivation from inside. Because if you tell people what to do, the moment you don't tell them what to do anymore, they will not do anything anymore. So you need to actually motivate them from inside. And according to Daniel Pink, intrinsic motivation is basically giving people a purpose, give them autonomy, and allow them to reach a certain mastery. So these are the three elements. And this is what I call, some people call them as well, facilitate and guide. You guide the people with a purpose to go in the right direction. I don't want to go south. I want to go north, or whatever you want to do. I mean, you are usually telling right now, I think, or we think this is the right direction. So it's giving this direction. So that's the guidance. And at the same time, let them facilitate that they can reach their success. So it's a lot about coaching as well. So it's giving them the autonomy, because you hire these people, you hire them because they are great, right? So then also work with that, that they can define how they're going to reach it, with what tools they're going to reach it, with which people they're going to reach it. So there's a lot of autonomy then. And this autonomy is creating a lot of motivation.
Yeah.
You don't need to tell the people what to do. And the ideal thing is you don't even need to tell them how to measure success. They should come up with themselves, right? And that's the more openness you give, the more transformational results you get. And this is then also, in terms of this mastery, that people want to become better and better and better. Right. The better you get at something, the more you realize how bad you are. It's actually quite interesting. I mean, you're getting better, and then you realize I'm getting further away from my target, because the target is actually accelerating faster than I become better. And that's that mastery thing, which is really motivating for a lot of people.
Yeah.
And that's that facilitate and guide, sitting there as a leader, discuss where we should go, define that as a reason, create a purpose where people care about. This is something I care about. I care about my customers. I care about we discussed maintenance before we started the podcast, caring about the production people, that they have a good, good running production. It's like creating this purpose and creating this care, and based on that, letting the people identify how they can solve it. And that's, I mentioned the workshop in Bangkok 2 weeks ago, and that's how you can create totally different ideas. And the regional operational director also mentioned in the past, we've been doing incremental improvements, and now we are thinking of how we are removing entire process steps.
Yeah.
Instead of improving the process step, why don't we think how we can remove it? And this is the step changes we need. And it's not that being 10% faster or cheaper or get 10% more revenue. It's about how can we totally change.
Yeah. Right. Okay, that sounds like an extraordinarily hard shift for leaders, from one paradigm that is all about being in charge and then giving direction, to suddenly stepping back and saying, now I'm a coach and I set a vision, I set a direction. I mean, the people we have now in leadership positions have come up the last 20, 25, 30 years through exactly the previous system, and through displaying the skills that are beneficial to coming up in that system. how can you help leaders who have come up in that old paradigm to shift? Is there any methods or any tools, any ways that you use? What has been successful in helping them to change?
As two things, you need to show them results. And either you can show results from other interventions where they can say, okay, maybe that works in my environment as well. I'll give it a try. And sometimes then in this context as well, I almost put them, there's one project where I put the leadership team into a situation where they could not command and control anymore. And that's quite interesting. Right? It's not that it was a surprise for them, but it was an interesting initiative as well, where it was about implementing a new strategy and how the team are then implementing that strategy into their daily work. And we discussed with the regional directors quite often how we can do it. And from what the directors said, they actually want to let the people go. But from what they did was command and control. So there was also sort of this sort of self-reflection where they actually want to be facilitate and guide, but this new mindset hasn't translated into new action.
Yeah.
And sort of we organized this workshop where we created for these different teams. It was cross-functional teams again, but for these different teams, we allowed them to create their own objectives and key results, OKRs.
Mm-hmm.
And the way we structured the workshop is that it was totally autonomous. So the teams were doing it and then were discussing the results with each of the team could actually choose one of the directors. So we give them even autonomy, who is the director they want to have as a sponsor.
Yeah.
So we did this workshop with full autonomy and we only involved the directors at certain points. And the only thing the directors were doing in these points was looking at what the teams came up with and give them a little bit of feedback and direction, facilitate and guide. And they were really very, very positively surprised with the results. And they said it from the very beginning as well. No, let them, they know the strategy. Let's refresh on that overall big picture strategy and let them work on themselves. But I think it took this experience actually doing this facilitate and guide that these people have then also started to change. I don't say that it was a big shift, but that sometimes you just need to almost force them into their luck. But in the end, you need to show them that there is a result. Right. Sometimes you need to show them that you actually have great people. Just give them the space to do their own stuff.
How is that on the part of the teams then? So if you have a leader you can really work with who is open and sees first results and you say, okay, we can work with him to make that shift and to get into that new paradigm. But then obviously the people, they have also been used to working in a certain way to get their instructions, to have certain structures in place that reinforce this whole command and control thing. And now suddenly, oh, we're shifting. Now it's facilitate and guide. Now you stream for yourself. Total autonomy, go. Do they take to it like really quickly? Or is that also a shift where you have to say, okay, I actually also have to work with the team and not only with the leader to make sure this really happens?
It's also a journey and it happens a lot faster than with the leaders.
Yeah.
Because it's not about that you need to create a lot of new things. The only thing you need to do is take away the restraints. They are so happy. Once they realize, oh, I'm actually allowed to say whatever I want. I actually did whatever I say is taken serious by whoever I'm talking to. Once they realize that this is there, it is just coming out. This shift happens relatively fast, but it's something you need to work on as well as that they are confident that they almost have the trust that they are not punished on what they're saying.
Yeah.
Because it happened in the past. So it's more about building that trust. And that also an area where it helps to be an independent sparring partner. Because we did a lot of these workshops with this senior managers, so that the people reporting to the directors did a lot of workshops with them. And there you see as well that there's a totally different dynamic if the directors are in the room or outside of the room.
Yeah, I could imagine.
But it's also good to see that the directors were fully aware of that and they actually voluntarily took themselves out.
Yeah.
Well, it should be a journey. I mean, in the end, it should be that they are open with the directors. But that's a journey where you need to work on and creating, first of all, giving them a new routine that they can speak out and are defining their own objective. Because it's true. I mean, if you just say what are your objectives? In some cases, they're just sitting there, I don't know. They cannot think about their own objectives. Yeah. But it's not that they cannot think about it. They just are not used to do that. You basically need to remove the restraints, open the lid. Yeah. It is a journey, but it's a much, much easier journey than really pushing that different leadership style.
Yeah. You mentioned the aspect of trust, which is often together with psychological safety, trust cited as being a key ingredient for a culture that is actually innovative, where all these different mindsets that we're now trying to instill in terms of design thinking and ideation, in terms of the willingness to fail, it kind of all relates back to, okay, do I feel safe at work to bring my full potential here, to bring ideas that are maybe left field, where maybe in the past people then said, no, this is crazy, we want to go for that 5% more, but now we actually expect them to really open up and bring much, much more to the table. So an organization that maybe in the past was not really high on trust and psychological safety, as usually is the case with this kind of command and control, how can that shift? How can you bring in step by step, of course it's a long process, this trust element?
I mean, there's different things to say here. One model I like to work with when it comes to trust is called the ABI model. I forgot now who came up with that, but I like it because it's only three elements, so it's easy to remember. But ABI stands for ability, benevolence, and integrity. And it's basically, I mean, there's a lot of different models and all of them are correct. It's just, I like this model because it only has three, not five or six elements to remember. And I think it covers the most important elements. And ability, yes. You can only trust somebody if you think this person is able to do it.
Yeah.
I mean, I would not trust myself to do something which I've never done before. So that contributes to trust. It's also this ability, the skills and the experience. I mean, and that's something we should not neglect. The other one is benevolence, and I think that's a very important factor for trust. I need to have the feeling that there's a mutual benefit we want to achieve. If I have the feeling that my counterpart is just taking whatever I give them and then for their own benefit, and they don't care about my benefit, then you cannot create a lot of trust or cultivate that trust. And with command and control, this is actually something which often happens, that I'm just looking at my sales targets and I'm not caring about the emotional state of my employees or the benefit of my employees. I'm pushing down on the salaries, but I'm pushing up on the revenue. I mean, there needs to be something to say, okay, where do the people feel? Okay, I'm helping with sales, for example, but it helps me as well.
Yeah.
So, and it's not just that I'm helping myself, it's also my boss is helping me in some way. So there needs to be something where we are growing together. So this benevolence, that we are helping each other, win-win situations, or whatever you want to call it. And the last bit of integrity is, I think that's the simple one, where we say, I mean, if I continue to give lies or untruths, or I continue to be inconsistent in what I'm talking about, for sure. I mean, I will never know what your body will say next, so I cannot cultivate that trust as well. So I think I like that as a model. So how do you put that model in practice? And that's one of the routines I mentioned before as well. It's just pushing the people to talk to each other as much as possible, because that creates understanding who this other person is, and that also builds these relationships. And once with better relationships, you will also be, you can cultivate trust.
Right.
And in addition to that, it also happens with that, what I mentioned before with this OKR is that we are putting cross-functional teams together to define their own objectives, and having common objectives helps a lot as well. So that's a little bit going into this benevolence thing, where I say, okay, me as one team can optimize in a certain element, but it will harm another department within the organization. But what we need to put the targets on an element where we go in the same direction. It's a little bit the purpose, the common objectives, which is helping a lot as well into trust, because they'll say, okay, yeah, we're sitting in the same boat, and getting this feeling of sitting in the same boat is important to trust. And yes, in the end, if you are in an environment where we have a certain level of trust, is much, much easier to be creative, much, much easier to go beyond typical results.
So in this shift to try to play more on the internal motivation of people, give them more leeway, more freedom, it sounds great by and large, assuming that all people are properly intrinsically motivated and like to work that way and also want to be part of a bigger whole and really contribute and be in this kind of relationship. Have you also seen situations where there are people who are really just there to do their job, to get their money, and then maybe use that new freedom to slack away and contribute less than before? Is that a concern at all?
It's definitely a concern. But how to deal with that? It's a good question. My immediate response to that is that they are in the wrong job.
Yeah.
Or they haven't identified themselves with the purpose. But if somebody's doing a job just to get the money and then run after another purpose, maybe they should run after the other purpose in the first place.
Right.
Or sometimes it might be worthwhile to identify, can we understand their purpose and relate it to the purpose we have in the company? And sometimes it's not a big problem. Sometimes it's not a big problem to have this ant or that bee in your organization who is just doing the job and then 9 to 5 and then leave again. But it might have an impact on overall team spirit as well. So it needs to be carefully addressed.
Yeah.
But I think I believe we need to have fun at work. We need to have fun at work. It needs to be something which I enjoy doing. So for me, this work-life balance is not about work and then I enjoy life, right? Work is part of life. So we need to enjoy it. And I think if somebody is not enjoying work, can we find a way that this person enjoys work? And this is the best solution.
Yeah.
Or can we find a way that this person finds enjoyable work somewhere else? So employability is a topic which is coming up as well. Helping these people to find their purpose. And as a good leader there as well, you should be not biased towards keeping people in your team.
Right.
But you should be you should work into a direction to make everybody happy.
Yeah.
And again, you should never burn bridges. And this person might come back with something totally different at a later stage and helping you. I think that's where, as a good leader, and I encountered a few of them in my experience so far, as a good leader, you just want to help. You just want to support. You just want to coach them that they can reach their objectives, what they want to achieve. Sometimes it starts with identifying what I want to do.
Yeah, absolutely. So for the leaders then, as they're kind of asked to give up control in this new paradigm, do you see that in any way they also maybe have anxiety? Oh, what is my role now? Now I'm not giving orders. Maybe I'm consulted, but am I still important enough for this organization in this function? Because they kind of come up in the hierarchy by first, I guess, having a lot of expert knowledge in one field, being promoted, then by managing people and managing to get the results they're supposed to get, being promoted. And now suddenly that control is gone. Do you see that they're dealing with some sort of fears and anxieties there, or are they actually also more happy in the new paradigm quite universally?
I saw one person who was super happy. He was a global VP for operations in a large organization. And through some projects, we had a very good relationship. And one day I saw him knocking off at 2:30 in the afternoon. I say, what are you doing? I'm going home. I finished my job. And we had a little bit of a discussion about it. I say, my job is not daily business. My job is to make things, to ensure that my people can work in an environment where everything is smooth. And at 2:30, very often he was working very hard, but he said, my job is done. So he was very happy in that situation because he basically delegated daily job work to his teams. He has enough confidence, or everybody should have enough confidence to delegate the work to there. And that's one story. And then another interesting story in this context as well, I talked to a country CEO in the previous organization, and he shared that he was so surprised that there is so much time of his work time is dedicated to fix personal issues. I mean, when he thought I'm now a country CEO, I mean, he will be involved in a lot of operational activities, and he had to spend, I think he mentioned 50% of his time, he's just fixing personal issues. And that's contributing to as well. I think you should not be afraid. If you just let go, you will still have a lot of things to do.
Yeah.
But it's then also bringing a lot more empathy and a lot more, it's different work. It's a totally different work. You basically become a coach and a mentor to your team.
Yeah.
And you don't need to tell them what to do. At the same time, you need to put a lot more efforts in building this team need and creating a purpose for the team. That's a lot of work. It's not done like, I mean, you don't think of it yourself. It's a process to come up with that purpose, but then also ensure that people are kept reminded on this purpose, that there's a continuous reminder. And it's, for example, a good practice to start every meeting with your purpose statement or with your objective. What do you want to do? And
interesting.
Yeah, I mean, just as an example, yesterday I kicked off a week-long workshop, which is a user acceptance test workshop for a big S, or not a big, but for an SAP implementation, which are typically not too small.
Yeah.
And a project manager also started with the objective of this week, but I then also kept people reminded on what is the objective of the overall project. And for sure, that's something related to our customers. We want to have better service and better products for our customers. That's the purpose why we're doing the SAP implementation. That's why we have this user acceptance test this week.
Yeah.
We're doing the user acceptance test this week, but we should still keep in mind, why are we doing this? And that's the role of a coach, of a mentor. And I think it's still a lot of work. But at the same time, but a fear of a lot of leaders comes actually, I think it comes from somewhere else. It's not coming from that shift from command and control to facilitate and guide. But I see it in many, many areas that we actually do have too many hierarchical levels.
Yeah.
But that's nothing to do with the leadership style. It's just that we simply have too many hierarchical levels. And I think there's something we need to be confronted with.
Right. Which is probably still a bit related, though, no? Because in the command and control style, you have the typical pyramid, the org chart. My favorite is always the one from the US train company from the 1900s, which is super structured, and you just see it going broader and broader to the bottom. And then you just need these nodes because somehow there's a limit to how many people one person can manage in a command and control style, because you have to both give the command, but also control that it happens. Mm-hmm. And then you have these huge pyramids where, I suppose, when we, for example, look at companies that have really embraced agile software development, Microsoft and so forth, they added more pooling resources and pulling them together project-based. You don't need all these people who are setting all these targets and controlling that they happen anymore.
The question is less hierarchical level. What is the cause and effect, basically? Are we having leaner or flatter hierarchies because we're shifting to command and control, or do we need command and control because we have less hierarchical levels? And I've also done an experience. I met a regional HR director for Siemens IT.
Yeah.
And they have implemented end of last year, beginning this year, that they only have three hierarchical levels. Three. Yeah. In an organization of roughly 600-700 people. You cannot do that with command and control.
Right.
And that they have to give a lot of autonomy to teams. There are teams which don't have a boss.
and
that's the right direction. That's the right action. But for me, it's more, we need to get, I think it's more about getting rid of hierarchical levels. And that's why we need to shift to facilitate and guide. So the fear is of getting rid of hierarchical levels. But I also admit that some people might think, oh yeah, I don't have control anymore. And it's not a fear. It's just a different habit.
Yeah.
So the problem there is more to not falling back to command and control, because I admit it's easier. it's easier to tell somebody to do it because they will do it.
Right.
But it doesn't mean that they will do it again. If you stop telling what people should do, they will stop doing things. But if you do that more on from within with a facilitator and guide style, it will happen even you're not doing anything anymore.
Yeah.
And it's more like nudging the people into the right direction. But because sometimes they might run off in a direction where you're a little bit scared on where they're heading to.
But it might be exactly the right thing to do.
Yeah, it might be exactly the right thing to do. So, but you need to see that might be the right thing to do, but might not be the right thing to do.
Yeah.
It depends.
Another topic we bridged earlier a bit was the whole topic of bridging silos within the organization. From the whole startup venture world, it's all breached that, yes, we need cross-functional teams at the table, et cetera. But of course, if we look then at more traditional organizations, maybe even very traditional regulated industries, like, for example, chemical and construction and mining and so forth are some of them. On the one side, what do you think is the importance in those kinds of areas and businesses of bridging silos? And is it actually in practice really possible? How can you get that done in the organization?
What is always an important, and that comes also from this knowledge management experience, an important aspect about silos are that they are important for efficiency. And we should never forget that. That's why some people say we should break the silos. No, you should. We need them. I mean, if you say, okay, let's just take if you take the manufacturing unit, for example, we just take away all the silos, everybody's just one team.
Right.
It doesn't work. You need to have people in a certain area which are focusing on what they're doing, maintenance, for example, or production or supply chain. So they're doing these things.
Yeah.
So that's important that we understand that we need silos for efficiency, but it's only for efficiency, not necessarily for effectiveness. And what you quickly realize when you look at operations that none of these silos can work by itself. They always are interdependent on each other. And that's why you need to, what you said as well, that's why you need to bridge these silos. It's important to bridge these silos, to build these connections. And that's also in the context of people excellence, where I say we need to have these people foundation, these relationships between the people. Because if something goes wrong, you need to discuss it.
Right.
If these silos, and some of these silos still in today's organizations, are sometimes these silos are so thick that they don't talk to each other, even they might be sitting next to each other, and very often they're not even sitting next to each other. They're like, oh, I have a problem, let's talk. I don't know you, who are you? But if you have like a constant sort of interaction where you, on a monthly basis, on a weekly basis, discuss what's going on, where do we do some planning exercises, and they might be very short, like 10, 20 minutes a week, or if you have this relationship with people and that's this bridge, then whenever there's an issue, you roll up your sleeves together and work on it.
Right? Yeah.
That's what I mean with people excellence, and that's what is important. And in this context, it's also important that there are common objectives. And that's one of the things in the previous company, in the manufacturing environment, talking about cement building materials. And these are big, big factories.
Right.
400, 500, 600 people, sometimes even more. And for sure, you have then these silos. There is 50 people working in a quarry, or 30 people working in a quarry sometimes. For sure, this is a team, right? And sometimes they're physically in a different space than, for example, the rest of the plant. But you need to make sure that there's a common objectives. And what we did that was a few years back now, before we introduced these common objectives, we could see that like each silo was optimizing on their own, not realizing that they're harming the rest.
Right.
And I'm taking this example of quarry and pre-processing plant in the cement industry. I'm just taking this example, but there's good examples everywhere. When the quarry is optimizing their energy consumption, in this case, they are creating chunks of limestone, which are rather big, because then they use less energy. But then you go to these chunks are then going to the pre-processing plant and they need to grind it down into sand. For sure, the bigger the chunks, the more energy they use. So actually we realize and that you only realize it when you bring the people together. If you can reduce these chunks in the quarry by using 10% more energy, you can halve the energy consumption in the pre-processing plant. But you only realize it when you start to, that the people are talking to each other.
Yeah.
And they're only willing to do it when they have common objectives. We need to reduce the energy consumption in the entire factory, not just in each individual silos. And that's why bridging silos is very important. And that's just one example. But then I mentioned the R&D teams as well, where this guy, but that was not just this guy expressed it, but many people experienced that as well. I need to talk to people from a different business unit or a different region. Regions are silos as well. We need to talk to each other and that we get better ideas and better solutions in a technology environment as well. So this bridging of silos and is always very important.
I suppose, especially when you're within an organization and you're don't really have an external customer, but basically you are providing one function within the organization. Under the old paradigm, it's like, yeah, okay, so this is what I do. These are the specifications of my job. Let me make that most efficient as possible. And then I go home. But actually, this whole paradigm of customer centricity also really extends to these internal units that you have to see, oh, actually, no, I do have a customer. It might not be somebody who's like directly paying for my product, but it's the next guy in the line who is part of my organization who then has to use my output. And actually, I need to be super customer-centric, maybe go over, see what they do, understand their problems to then actually optimize my function, not by for myself. It has to be comfortable or energy efficient, but my customer has to get the best possible input for them, right?
Yeah. Yeah, it's that value chain within any organization where we realize when I'm creating value for the next unit in the value chain. And one of the important things, I just had a thought around it as well, it's actually very dangerous in many cases to actually create these SOPs. Now I even forgot what SOPs
are. Standard operating procedures.
Standard operating procedures. Because then you're not working for the customer anymore. You're working for the standard operating procedure and you're trying to optimize yourself according to what's written there. But you can never make an SOP so detailed that it covers everything what your customer needs.
Right.
And I think what we need to come to understand, who is my customer, what are their issues, what are their challenges, and have a mindset. And again, and we need to see what are the routines going to that mindset, having a mindset which is, if I make my customer successful, it's my success.
Yeah.
And only then it's success. It's not a success when I optimize for myself, because it might hurt my customer. When my customer is hurt, the entire organization, I mean, in the case of manufacturing, the entire organization is hurt then as well. And I think that's important to understand, like looking at the picture, yes, being in a silo to be efficient, but not forgetting the big picture on where we go heading to. And the great results we saw, for example, in the workshop 2 weeks ago in Bangkok, is where we actually came up with improvement ideas in larger cross-functional teams, still within the factory, but with large cross-functional teams. And that's how they were possible to look at solution ideas, which they never came up before.
Yeah.
I mean, one guy said, I'm working in for 22 years in this factory now. And in these 22 years, I never, ever saw that such kind of ideas that came up. And it's not that the people are new. It's just the process was new. The process to come up with ideas was new.
Yeah.
And he was really, really surprised on the quality of the ideas. And that's why you need to work across silos.
But which is probably a mix of, otherwise, like giving people transparency, right? What does that actually all look like? How is the organization functioning? The other different people, what are they doing? But then also they have to come with a good amount of empathy to then say, okay, it's not about me, it's actually about the other guy. And I'm going to have to then also adjust my definition of success according to that.
Yeah, and I think you mentioned empathy, and what we used in this workshop as well was design thinking. And one of the things I like about design thinking is that we are creating a lot of understanding what is the challenge. I think that helped a lot. But then also doing that in a cross-functional team, that combination of pushing, and sometimes you really have to push the people, or more like holding back the people in staying into understanding the challenge before they jump into solution ideas. There you really have to hold the people back. Sometimes they just, oh, I have these great ideas. No, let's, what is actually the challenge?
Yeah.
And it's difficult to keep the people in that one. in that space first, and but doing that in a cross-functional area, also this good discussion, who is my customer? I mean, one of the challenges we had was about wastewater treatment, and it was not that easy to identify who is the customer for wastewater treatment.
Yeah.
Is it the government regulators? Is it the society around the factory? Is it production? And maybe it's all of them. So that's the difficult to do. Sometimes it's difficult to understand who is your customer.
Right.
Way, way back, I was working, also consulting in the pharmaceutical industry as well. And there we have the same discussion. Who is my customer? The doctor, the patient, the health insurance, the family of the patient. And it's not always that easy, right?
I mean, yeah.
And most of the time, yeah, you have actually an ecosystem of customers, but then understanding each individual needs and insights and then contributing to that challenge, it's important to go through that process and not just come up with, we can tweak this process by 10%.
Yeah, this is usually, interestingly, also a criticism that I often hear about design thinking, where people say, oh, design thinking only produces incremental results. But then when you kind of look at, well, how have you done it? It's like, okay, so we take the same customer profile that we used before. We take the same problem definition that we used before, and we just jump right into coming up with new ideas for how to solve exactly the same formulated problem, where it's then, okay, stop. So the first two steps is actually do your research, because things change. If you have done your research 5 years ago or 10 years ago, sorry, this is not the same person anymore. The profiles have shifted, pain points have shifted, motivators have shifted. And then the problem definition, where maybe in the past, because you had a limited resolution, you kind of stopped at asking why the first time, and you found a pain point that is maybe actually more of a symptom. And then you said, okay, this is the problem, let's solve it. Maybe this time around, we can actually go a bit deeper and then maybe ask another time, why is that? And find a new insight that we can actually define as the problem. And this is where suddenly we can talk about 10x instead of 10%.
Yeah, exactly.
But somehow people love to jump into solutions.
I always see it my task, or as a facilitator, if you do these workshops, the task is of the facilitator and design thinking to really hold the people back to jump into solution ideas. And what I tell them as well, if you think this is the solution, and you go deep in this path, then you might not discover other paths of solutions or directions.
Absolutely.
Of solutions. And that's the danger. That's why you need to hold back. That's why you need to keep your mind open and look broad.
Yeah.
And I think that's very important. And in this context, also an interesting story, where I did a design thinking exercise in a smaller context, was more like getting people experience in what it is. And we had one challenge, we defined on one challenge, which was improving knowledge sharing within that organizational unit. And then we split into three teams, and then doing the brainstorming in three teams. And they came up with three absolutely, totally different ideas on how to solve the same challenge.
Yeah.
And that's also interesting to see, because it's, yeah, and that's why you need to be broad. And then in the end, you can bring these ideas together and then consolidate it. But that's amazing for me to see as well. And that's just, that space between people can be very different, even in the same team.
The space between people.
I like that space between people. It's
absolutely. Cool. I mean, we covered really a lot of different topics within this field. So maybe just to summarize, to wrap it up, when you look back at what you've learned in change management during larger transformations, what for you are like the three most important principles that you have learned through experience when you're trying to successfully manage that kind of change?
Well, if I would boil it down to three, I think one of the most important thing is purpose. Giving people the something they care about. And I briefly mentioned this energy saving initiative, and there how we reformulated or we give it a different name is that we said this is about energy saving, but in the end, it's about saving our planet or creating a better future for the next generations.
Yeah.
Because if you save energy, especially in more the countries which are not as developed, any kind of energy is always related to pollution. And that's how you can create a better future for the next generation. So it's that kind of purpose and create something which people care about. People don't care about EBITDA. Very, very honestly, they do not care about EBITDA. And that's where you need to find an angle where you, whatever transformation you do, you need to formulate it in a way that people care about and you give them a purpose. That purpose for me is very, very important. The second thing is that, and the space between people is that there should be a good focus on building relationship between people and specifically between people across silos. And it's that space, these relationships, which then will come up with new ideas, come up with a feeling that you are in the same boat. And there's this feeling together. I mean, a lot of successful companies, when you feel it's a family, and when you have this kind of feeling, you can achieve a lot more than it's just a set of individuals. I mean, it's in sports as well. Yeah. It's the team spirit, which is important, not the individual potential. So it's that the purpose, the connection between people, and then it's how you motivate and engage people. And there I like to go according to this intrinsic motivation of Dan Pink, which is purpose. But it's more than just purpose. I mean, it's also giving people the autonomy, and that's where all this facilitate and guide comes in as well. You motivate via facilitate and guide. And you really get the best out of people. And I think for me, this, in most transformation, this is what it is about.
Right.
Giving people a purpose, connecting the right people together across the different silos, and then engage and motivate and make it fun. I think that's important in the end as well.
Fantastic. Tim, thank you so much for your time. It was
thanks
a very
so
insightful conversation.
Yeah.
And I hope that our listeners also get quite some inspiration out of this.
It was a good conversation. Thanks a lot.
Thank you for listening to this episode of Lost in Transformation with our host Sebastian from Ming Labs. If you enjoy our podcast, please subscribe to our channel and leave us a review on iTunes. Join us next time for another episode of our podcast.